Thank you very much. I feel really lucky to be able to talk about emerging environments, new environments for smoke-free policies after that last talk. So it gets better. No, what to say there. And I have no relevant conflicting financial relationships to disclose, to get that out of the way. Just want to give a quick overview of the sectors I want to talk about today, and I actually want to say these aloud, and if people could raise their hands if they've worked in this area on smoke-free policy or if they're thinking about it, just so I can get a sense of where experience and interest is. Has anyone worked on smoke-free housing or has an interest there? Great. Parks? Hospitals? Mental health and chemical dependency treatment, and colleges. And I'm only going to speak really briefly about that. I think the people in the room might have had more luck there than we have so far. It's a moving place for us. And then I want to touch briefly on the community mobilization education that we've done around our work. So just for a bit of background, in Washington State, our Clean Air Act came from a citizens initiative, which means it didn't have to go through the exemption process that a lot of other laws have around the country, and it's one of the strongest in the nation. And what I mean by that is it prevents smoking in any workplace, not just indoor workplaces, but outdoor workplaces as well, patios or other outdoor construction work sites, and it also prohibits smoking within 25 feet of an air intake or door. So we're starting with a really strong base there. But we know that secondhand smoke exposure, which is a known hazard, persists even in indoor environments like multi-unit housing and outdoor environments as well. And we also know from looking at our county's data that this exposure is more frequent among lower-income populations and non-white populations. And this is especially relevant for us in looking at our tobacco use profile in our county. We have a really low tobacco use rate. It's 13%, which feels really good, but we actually have the biggest disparity between black and white smoking in the entire country of metropolitan areas, and we're just about as close when it comes to higher income populations and lower income populations. I have some interesting icons that have popped up in my presentation here. Add some spice. So one question I think that some people may be having who haven't moved into this work, or even if you're in this work, is why move beyond the workplace? We know the indoor exposure and the equity of workers being able to work in smoke-free environments. And for us, we know secondhand smoke exposure still incurs in different environments within our county. We also have an interest in pushing those social norms further, like Sarah was just talking about. It's laughable to us that people used to smoke on airplanes. And in King County, you can already say, can you believe when people smoked in bars? And in 10 years, we want people to be able to say, wow, could you believe there was smoking in parks? So that's what we're pushing towards. We also know that smoke-free areas support quit attempts, and there's great studies coming out around total workplace campus bans, as well as college campus total campus bans, that they do reduce smoking overall and supporting those quit attempts. And we're also interested in modeling for youth. We know parents influence youth smoking, and so looking at the adult modeling for youth as well as other youth. We had a huge opportunity to broaden the number of sectors we were working in by the Communities Putting Prevention to Work, or CPPW, grant that we received. It was actually a $10 million grant to work in tobacco control, and it allowed us to take on a vision that was being able to transform our community over the course of about 2 years, where there were noticeable changes in the number and types of places where smoking was allowed and where it wasn't. And in some ways, this was a fast-forward button on work that we've been grooming, projects we were developing, but it also allowed us to have new capacity for projects, and it allowed us to have additional staffing to be working in more places at once. And for the first time in a long time, we had capacity to staff at external partners who were making these changes in their organizations. So looking at our approach, we, as you're going to see when I talk, this is primarily voluntary at the organizational level, meaning a housing authority or a hospital taking on the policy, rather than us regulating. Even though King County is not a Tea Party county, we still risk being seen as over-regulatory and hear that a lot, and we wanted to save our capital and political relationships for working on things in the retail environment where the voluntary is not quite as tenable a strategy. We used our money to get change done. We gave out large competitive grants through a competitive grant process, and by large I'm talking around the $100,000 to $200,000 range to our large housing authorities and to our park systems. But we also had, and are still giving out, a big variety of small mini grants, around $3,000, that people are using some portion of to just put up signage to get this moving at their organization if they've already been thinking about it. One lesson that we've learned going along the way, working with different types of organizations, is to do value-directed outreach. So the slide I just showed about why go beyond smoke-free, that's just the tip of my public health laundry list of why this is good policy for anywhere. But when I sit down with a mental health and chemical dependency treatment center, they don't want to see the long list. They want to talk about the social justice issue. And when I sit down with housing management, they don't want to see the long list. They want to talk about why this is responsible portfolio management. So a lot of the work for us was identifying what the different values are in different sectors to be able to communicate on the level of where the decision makers were at. We did coalition building, and this means both bringing together members within the same sector or making the same changes at the same time so they could troubleshoot together and also support each other. We had found in the past when we used to do this work on a smaller capacity that we would have one housing building go smoke-free, we'd do a press release, and the reporter would go out and they would find the disgruntled smoker who was in a wheelchair or using a walker and talk about how this was going to ruin their life and pry the cigarette out of their cold, dead hands. But when we came out with a press release that 9 housing providers were going smoke-free at the same time, that was from the same reporters, was a wonderful press item. It got a lot more coverage, and it was all positive. So just building the networks together of the sectors moving was really important for us. And we also decided to focus our resources in the areas of largest exposure and also in youth areas, because that matches our tobacco profile in King County, and it's where we're going to get the biggest impact. So now I just want to go through these different sectors and talk about our lessons for what has worked and what hasn't worked. So just to give you a sense of where we're at with smoke-free housing, we're looking at having over 10,000 units covered by new policies for smoke-free, and this is in over 10 providers, including 2.5 of our housing authorities, one is a little slower moving, as well as nonprofit affordable housing developers. Like I mentioned, the voluntary organizational policy is key here. Housing does not want to be regulated in King County. We passed a resolution with our Board of Health recommending policy, and that was perceived as too regulatory. Just putting out a model policy was perceived as too regulatory by some of these partners. The key thing that was great for these partners was having a roadmap that we tested in some of our work before, leading up to getting a CPPW grant, about how to go smoke-free when you're in a housing environment. And a key piece was how to engage your residents, how to do surveying, and when to do public meetings. And being able to hand out that roadmap with the time dates on it and the legal concerns, our kind of lay view of them, really helped people move along. Like I mentioned, we were able to give grants for partner staffing. A new piece for us in hiring the new staffing that we did specifically to work on housing was learning a lot more about the housing environment and how the funding flows towards housing. So we were actually able to leverage the networks where the affordable developers meet together and have conversations together and choose initiatives and get into that network, as well as look at what the funding streams were. And we could actually worked with that consortium of developers and the funders to add 7 incentive points on a scale of about 100 for smoke-free policies in the common application for public housing funding within the state of Washington, a systems change that we didn't even know was within our reach when we started doing this work. The mini grants for signage, a lot of folks who we didn't, like I said, we have 10 partners going, and only 3 of those got large grants, and everyone else has these small grants that just help them put up signage and take that out of their budget. And also with the housing providers, the discussion of being green and putting it in a sustainable context, because that's where a lot of affordable housing concentration and talk is right now. So that's their current topic of the moment. This is one of my favorite images from our work, and I don't have the after yet. I hope too soon. But this is a picture from a portfolio, an apartment within the portfolio of a nonprofit provider that we worked with. And you can see where the tar has been wiped off the wall from where the person turns on the light switch. So hopefully I'll have the after to this soon. I know it's cleaned up now. But this kind of indicates who may live in the housing that we're working with. And the biggest barrier we found working with housing was people who are providing supportive housing. And the concern about who you're alienating when you say your housing is smoke-free, and being able to work with folks around changing their perception of what housing first is, that you can still house people in a smoke-free environment and you're not going to kick people to the curb. And also it pointed our eyes towards additional systems to change to make. For instance, with housing funding in the state of Washington and in King County, there's not only infrastructure dollars and capital dollars, there's service dollars that are awarded as well within grants. So now we're looking at, can those service dollars be used for cessation and pair that with a smoke-free policy that's tied to the capital dollars? So moving on to parks, We've had a little bit of a slower start here, which I'll get to in a second, but our goal is of the 29 jurisdictions in our county, we want 22 of them to have tobacco or smoke-free policies in place. And we found right away, we heard this from our Parks Department that works with these 29 park superintendents, that moving together was what was going to work. Nobody wanted to stick out their neck out. The City of Seattle actually worked on a policy 2 years ago and 2 days later pulled it way back from a full policy to a strange, you can't smoke within 25 feet of another person, which again, imagine how that gets enforced. So no one wanted to stick their neck out, but this was on all the parks directors' minds and they wanted to move together. So we funded them to come up with common signage so that when you walked into these parks, it was going to be clear that nobody worked alone. There's an image of it. And we also called in technical assistance from cities like New York and Los Angeles that had already implemented policies to learn their tips, because this was new to us and we wanted to build our capacity on it. And again, having values-directed outreach, they didn't want to talk about secondhand smoke exposure as much because the science there is only the very close proximity exposure, but talking about youth and clean environments was really important to them. And like I said, honing our best message there, and not to talk about the secondhand smoke and acknowledge where the evidence is, but also to align with what the parks directors are trying to provide to their communities, aligning with the other policies in place, explain to them that this isn't building a whole new policy for you. You can tack it into your code of conduct where you have your alcohol use and off-leash dogs rule. The political timing issue was a huge lesson learned for us that may come up in some of your communities if you're looking at this. Parks, you can have voluntary policies, essentially resolutions, but these decisions are going to be made by a mayor or a city council or a county council or by a parks board, and they're going to be legislative, which means they have a little bit more political valence. In our county, we had to delay our issue for about 5 months because our county executive and county council were working on a life jackets regulation that had to go in place in an emergency fashion beginning the summer to prevent drownings in really over-flooded rivers. But nobody wanted to talk to us about parks after doing life jackets, and it took about 5 months for us to get a chance to work with our county on that. Since we were trying to move this regional thing all together, talking consistently to partners and doing a little pitting people against each other, the healthy competition where you call up a city and you say, oh, well, your such and such neighbor is about to have their tobacco-free park, so maybe you want to get back on board as well. And then we have had a surprising number of parks directors who have come to say to us, wow, it's great that you're making parks smoke-free, but nobody smokes in our parks, so that won't be an issue for us. So we're taking a page from what New York has done and Los Angeles has done, and specifically some work out of Austin, Texas, to do butt cleanups and provide those decision makers with big jars of butts. And then the project in Austin, one of the projects they did was to put little red flags where all the cigarette butts were in public and open spaces. So here's my ode to Halloween and also to Austin's work that we're hoping to replicate soon. We've had great work with hospitals, primarily, I think, because of some of the national initiatives to get cessation treatment more organized in hospitals, that this was already a will that was building in the organizations, and us coming in and being able to lend a little more capacity, and in many cases a little more expertise around tobacco, let them go forward and put policies on their books. And the specific capacity, we paired this with developing cessation protocols as well, working with their electronic medical records to have the appropriate tobacco intervention questions that would guide treatment of patients, and also even working with gift shops in some cases to sell discounted NRT. We got pharmacies in the hospitals to break apart packs of gum so that if somebody was visiting someone and they were nervous about smoking, they could just buy a couple pieces of gum for a buck or two, which lowered a barrier to getting nicotine replacement right there. We didn't have a good grasp of the policy systems at hospitals and made some lucky finds and looking at how those work, where we could leverage policy that existed. A lot of the hospitals in our community have off-ward restrictions that were really in conflict with prior policies that allowed patients to go off-ward to smoke. How do you keep someone on ward and still let them go smoke when they can't smoke indoors? So there was a really tight fit there between a policy goal that already existed and that was important to the hospital and between the policy that we were talking about with them. And again, early and frequent communications to all stakeholders and neighbors became really important when we looked at hospitals because our hospitals are often located in pretty dense urban areas. Facilities management, not only in the hospitals, but some of the other sectors I've talked about as well. And the gift shop, for instance. Some lessons learned here for us. One of our hospitals that isn't willing to move is actually our regional children's hospital. And they're concerned that the ability to use tobacco, the ability to use nicotine, or specifically tobacco to get nicotine while your child is in treatment, is an unalienable right and unalienable comfort of your patients. So we're still working on building constituency within that organization and thinking about where the possibility for change is. Luckily, most children's hospitals in the country are tobacco-free, so we have some good models to borrow from. And then a nice lesson learned here was also about looking at other systems that affect the hospital and looking at employee cessation benefits. Our hospitals, at least one of them, did change their plan to eliminate co-pays for both the insured and their partners and spouses as part of their hospital policy change. And cruising right through to mental health and chemical dependency care, we were really lucky here to work with the funding agency for publicly funded mental health and chemical dependency treatment that sits within our own county and another branch of our own government, and build up our partnership by being able to give them a grant. That was really powerful. And again, they're the aggregator organization, so it really makes our effort easier when we're not having to reach out to 77 individual sites, but we're primarily reaching out to the funding organization and then giving support to those sites as needed through our health educators. I'm sure as some of you in the room are aware, if you've started to do this work, that this is a culture shift to work with mental health and chemical dependency. And my image there, which might not be that recognizable, is what sits on my desk to remind me of this work. And I don't think it would have made it through airport security, but it's actually an automatic cigarette lighter that used to be mounted on the door to one of our treatment centers, right outside the door, because you didn't want patients to have lighters, but you needed to make it as easy as possible for them to smoke. So this used to be mounted there. It's not there now. There's now, this is a tobacco-free for recovery sign, so a huge transition. Part of what helped us with making that transition, again, there wasn't a huge amount of success to be had from public health knocking on the door and saying, this is healthy for your clients. There was more pickup with a social justice issue, but it was really when our county's head of chemical dependency treatment got his providers together and told a personal story for him about 20 years ago helping a client kick a drug addiction and go on to lead a recovery-free life and then die of lung cancer 5 years later, and his regret and guilt that he never once mentioned nicotine or tobacco use to this patient. And that so he felt directly implicated in that patient's death after working with them so successfully on a drug recovery. And that's really motivating to providers in our area, because everyone has experienced that uniformly because the rate of tobacco use is so high among people with mental health and chemical dependency issue. In fact, the story was so motivating, and this work has been so motivating, that we have seen our providers step up and say, we want a coalition to continue this work after CPPW goes away, after funding goes away. We'll take what support from the health department we can get, but we're beginning to see how important it is to move this forward. So we're trying to put as much fuel on that fire as we can right now. And of course, pairing with cessation support is really important for the mental health and CD community. And just a few lessons learned here, not very surprising. Chemical dependency treatment, especially in Washington State, is losing funding right now, just like tobacco, but it's making it hard for them to adopt new contract requirements around treatment and being tobacco-free. And a lot like looking at our housing, when we look at cessation services, aren't as available in Washington as they used to be for people of lower income. Our agencies, though they can bill for dependency treatment, can't bill specifically for cessation treatment, and they hide it in their group drug counseling sessions. So that points us in our next direction as public health. We're to partner with them on systems changes to get that reimbursable within their system so they don't need to be worrying about their paperwork and they can do funding. And I've just put in some sustainability piece in the lower right hand of that slide. In addition to the coalition, we've also been working with peer counselors, because the cessation treatment is difficult to fund and difficult to come by. We've been building capacity among peer folks, clients who are currently in treatment, so that they can be the treatment counselors around tobacco addiction. And it's also some on-the-job or job training for them while they're in treatment as well. So that's a sustainability component that we've built. And then just briefly to look at colleges and universities, we're really just getting our feet wet here, but want to work with about four community colleges in the next year or so. What's been promising with these folks is the mini-grant approach. We put out competitive dollars, large grants, for our colleges, and we only had one take us up on it, and we were surprised because who doesn't want money? But the truth is they're not really ready to have a conversation about a smoke-free policy, though they are ready to have a conversation about a smoke-free principal and having healthier students. So being able to have small pots of mini grants available to say, okay, here's just a little bit of money to survey your students or to bring together a meeting of the people who are the decision makers on this, we'll help you do that, and you don't have to bite off the whole banana. Again, as we have had success in the other sectors, we're looking for the aggregator in colleges. And for us in King County, that would mean our community college district. And we want to work with them for a recommendation, a resolution, or if we're lucky, a policy, rather than go out to all of our community colleges. Lessons learned is this is the administrative process that we understand the least. Student turnover, faculty turnover has made this a bit of a challenge for us. And we also weren't expecting student safety concerns to be such a compelling argument to a lot of the faculty about what happens if students are going off campus to smoke. So those are some things we've addressed. But here's some early outcomes from our college work. This is a student project showing an educational campaign around smoking, which leads me to our kind of bigger education and mobilization work. We've also funded and been working with community organizations to develop stories around tobacco's impact on their lives as well as obesity, and to tell those stories and to make them available to policymakers and other community makers. And we've just launched a map where you can see all these things breaking out and get a good visual sense. And on this map, you can click, show me the tobacco-free sites. At the same time, when we look at our vision of a tobacco-free King County, we really have the sense of how all our places connect, and we can picture the people who smoke in King County moving from a hospital that we've worked with to a mental health and treatment chemical dependency center. But our sectors don't want to talk to each other. They don't have time. It's not in their bandwidth. So that's been a lesson learned for us. And I think a really important thing to touch on before I finish is to say, what if we didn't have the money? I've just talked about a lot of sectors we've worked with and a lot of success we've had, but I think this is replicable without a large grant. And my thoughts here would be to look at who the aggregator is, as I've been talking about. Think about who leverages the policies that are happening in that sector already, and how can you work with them? What are their values? What gets you in the door? And focus your resources on where the biggest exposure is or where you're most likely to have success. So with that, I'll show my favorite picture again. And do we have time for one or two questions now?
Is the University of Washington smoke-free?
That is a good question. The University of Washington has signs all over their campus that say they're smoke-free, but they actually have designated smoking spots within that smoke-free policy that's made it really hard to work with our other colleges who pointed at that. One of our hospitals is located adjacent to the University of Washington campus, and so we're using the momentum we built with the hospital to move up through campus and start some movement there around getting rid of those smoking spaces.
We've had a problem with unions not wanting to agree to the policy because it changes the conditions of employment, and these days of budget cuts, they're not giving out anything. Have you encountered that at all?
We've encountered different things with different unions, and I'm trying to think of some specific examples. We have not had any unions that have directly come out and opposed this, but the hospitals, I think, is the one where it was most important to bring them to the table early on. And we thought, oh, this is, you know, we're going to have to do some extra work. And then we heard from both the unions that work with our large hospitals that, no, this is something they're interested in the health for their union members, too, which may be a West Coast thing, maybe a King County thing. But maybe they can reach out to other chapters who feel differently about the policy. Might be a step there. Yes,
okay.
Yeah, sorry.
So you talked a little bit about the great work that you did in hospitals, and I'm particularly interested in the process that you went through to sell the NRT in what sounded like daily doses or smaller. Did you need to pursue a waiver from the FDA to do that?
We've tried to replicate it in other environments, and I'm trying to remember our procedure. I think it goes through, you have to use an approved repackager, and so this was all done at the hospital, by the hospital, totally their idea with our support, and so they worked out some of the more legal issues around it. We put in a question to the FDA, and I believe our answer back, though I will have to go look it up for you, is that we, because we were looking at doing this on a broader scale, was to use an approved pre-packager, repackager, and they told us where that was. Because the pharmacy is co-located within a hospital, I think pharmacies have more leeway about how they do that dispensing, and I think they were heavily involved in getting that change for the gift shops.
Oh, there's one in the back. Later.